This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting this program at KUOW. Thanks for tuning in. President Donald Trump is planning to sign another executive order on immigration as early as today. This one will be aimed at slowing America's refugee program and temporarily barring immigrants from some Middle Eastern countries. Liz Jones is a reporter on KUOW's immigration team, and she spoke with some Seattle families who might be affected by this order. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Bill.
We have not seen the final order that the president will sign. What should we expect to be in it?
Right. We haven't seen the final draft, but several media outlets have leaked a draft of what is expected this week. And here's what it would do. It would end the Syrian refugee program indefinitely. So that is Syrians coming here to the U.S. It would ban all refugees coming here for at least 4 months. So puts the refugee program effectively on hold for a while. When that program restarts, it will be dramatically downsized. It'll be cut in half from about 110,000 people allowed in per year to the U.S. down to 50,000 per year. And then let's talk about this Muslim ban that we heard about during Donald Trump's campaign. So in a recent interview with ABC this week, Trump says it's not a ban, it's just restrictions. But here's what we're seeing in this draft order. It's a temporary ban on all immigrants coming here from 7 majority Muslim countries. These are Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Yemen, and I think I got them all. Mm-hmm. So it would suspend immigration from those areas, from those countries for 30 days. So the reason that the government is giving for that is it's going to give them time to shore up what is already a very rigorous vetting process for people coming here. This extreme vetting, as we've heard about during the campaign. And the order says that admitting anyone from those 7 restricted countries, quote, is detrimental to the interests of the U.S.
Okay, again, this order that we haven't seen come down yet is for refugees and immigrants. How does it affect families who are already here, Liz?
Yeah, so looking at Washington State, every year we have about 3,000 refugees who come and resettle here. The last fiscal year, it was even more at about 4,000. And these are people who are fleeing from persecution, war, conflict. It's safe to say that all those recent arrivals have friends and family overseas, some in very precarious situations, and they've been waiting to help bring them here, to help sponsor them to come here. So the suspension of all refugees is putting that on hold, putting that separation much longer for all of these families. And in this process, the approvals expire. Like, you get a health screening that expires. You get this interview done that expires. So it's going to delay this process for a lot of people. I spoke with Marwa Sadiq. She's with the Iraqi Community Center in Kent. She's Iraqi. She actually grew up in Syria, though, and she's been in the U.S. about 16 years. They work with a lot of brand new Iraqi and Syrian refugees here in the Seattle area in Kent. And she told me she's worried about people that are here who may lose their benefits, programs like hers that may lose funding. But she's mostly worried about people overseas, in particular, people in Iraqi who may have worked with the U.S. military or have U.S. ties. They're often targeted by militants and they're not safe in Iraq. And she says it can take several years for them to obtain special visas to come here. And she's worried for them. And she's also worried for those who have fled and they're living in limbo somewhere else.
The ones who left everything, you know, in Iraq and moved to Jordan or Turkey or staying in refugee camps, they've been waiting to, you know, come here for years. Their kids are not going to school. You know, they're not doing anything. They're just waiting for a hope to come here and start a new life.
And I also asked Marwa whether these refugees have the option to even return home.
There's no way they can do that. There's no way. There isn't home anymore. You know, Iraq or Syria, both countries are destroyed. There's no life back there.
So the draft of the executive order we've seen also talks about setting up safe zones in Syria, so where people can take refuge. There's concern that could escalate the U.S. involvement in the Syrian conflict. But just to recap, of the 4,000 refugees arriving in Washington State last year, about 1 out of every 3 was from one of these restricted 7 countries.
We're going to be talking more about safe zones in Syria later this afternoon on All Things Considered, by the way, here on KUOW. Talking with immigration reporter Liz Jones, you have talked with immigrants who've heard this rhetoric from Donald Trump on the campaign trail. So far, is it as bad as they feared?
I think what I'm hearing from people is it's as bad, if not worse, than what they feared. I spoke to an Iraqi woman yesterday who told me this week is the first time she really feels afraid. They've been hearing the rhetoric all along, but that shock is just setting in now, and this fear is becoming a reality. I just stopped into a maternity service yesterday that helps immigrant and refugees with their pregnancies, and they hadn't seen the order come out yet, and you could just see the chill go through the room, the shock on their face. It was kind of awful to be the bearer of bad news, and people broke down in tears. But they're helping pregnant women, and they see their fear and their worry, and they're worried that's going to get even worse for these women. I spoke to Willow Wilson. She's a comic book writer and a novelist in Seattle. She's also Muslim, and she has family in the Middle East. She says seeing the expected details of the executive order really sends a chill through the community and a new sense of dread.
I know a lot of people who were originally saying, we're going to stay, we're going to fight this, we're going to trust that the checks and balances of government are going to work, who are now not so sure and who are thinking we might have to flee. I mean, this is becoming a real concern.
So as bad as they feared, yes, and possibly worse.
With this order then, Liz, in the attempt to ban refugees and some Muslim immigrants, how are these families, what are they doing? How are they planning for their future?
I think a lot just being on alert for what's might come next. And they've been on alert for a while now. Marwa Sadiq with the Iraqi Community Center. She said they're giving out people wallet-sized cards to carry around so that they know their rights, they know who to call. And she also said they're going to fight this, just like they did after September 11th.
Where we partnered with, like, you know, ACLU and other organizations, where we supported the community, and because there was a lot of, like, you know, FBI and immigration officers going into the families' homes. So we were there with them one-on-one, you know, supporting and advocating for the families. And we will continue to do that.
And I think the final thing I'll say about how people are preparing throughout the election, you know, we heard talk of a possible Muslim registry as well. And you probably heard people saying, you know, who oppose this registry is saying, I will sign up as a Muslim.
Right, allies.
Allies, as a way to show their solidarity and support for Muslims. Well, Willow Wilson, the comic book writer, had some thoughts on this.
If there is a Muslim registry, it's not going to look like it's looked on social media. It's not going to be, you know, this cartoonish thing where people have to go and physically sign up somewhere. It's not going to be that easy to fight. I know a lot of people have said, well, if there is a registry, we'll sign up. It's not going to be that simple. And I think we have to be on alert for subtler things that, you know, at first it's going to be about keeping out foreigners. Then it's going to be about registering who does and doesn't go to a mosque. You know, it's going to be sweeps of social media to see what people are commenting on. It's going to be much more insidious. And I think that's what people have to be on the alert for. It's not going to be, as straightforward as people anticipate.
So I should just reiterate, we haven't seen the details of this executive order yet. We haven't seen a registry yet, but people are on the alert and they're braced for big changes coming.
That's KUOW immigration reporter Liz Jones. Thank you, Liz.
Thank you, Bill.
And now on the record, we talk to somebody who's already here. She's immigrated here, lives in Tukwila. She's wondering what happens next. She's in a program known as DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. In the campaign, Donald Trump said he would end the DACA program. Graciela Nunez Pargas and her family came here from Venezuela when she was 7 years old. They had visas, but they overstayed and they lost their legal status. Now Graciela is 22 and a college graduate, and she told me the DACA program had a huge impact on her life just as she began her college career at the University of Washington.
I was immediately offered an undergraduate research assistant position at the political science department, and I was able to do voting rights research as an undergrad. And that's how it changed it. I went from just being a high school student to being a research assistant for the Department of Political Science. I was able to see a path ahead of me.
Because you had this DACA
yeah.
status?
Yes, because I was able to legally work in the United States, and I was able to wake up every morning and not think about the implications of deportation. That's how it changed it. I finally was able to see what I could do with my degree. I was able to see more of a path, a structured path into the American dream.
Now, we're not sure whether President Trump is going to eliminate the DACA mm-hmm. program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. If that happens, what, practically speaking, what would that mean for you?
It would mean that now that I have my college degree, now that I have my BA in political science, that I went through all this struggle and all these years of studying, of hoping, of even working for the Hillary Clinton campaign as a field organizer and the Washington State Democrats, it would mean that I fought so hard to just go back to being under the shadows. Under the shadows or living in the shadows. That would mean that I would not be able to legally work in the United States anymore. I would no longer be a legal economic contributor to taxes or social welfare programs that get deducted from my paycheck. I will no longer be able to apply for jobs. And it will also mean that the likelihood of me having to get fraudulent documents to legally work in the United States, it would just completely vanish any sort of upward mobility I was hoping to get from the program.
If the Trump administration were to pull out this DACA program, you'd lose that status. What would be your next move?
I have no idea. I don't think I've planned that far ahead. Currently, I was approved until January 2019. So I feel like I'm going to just live on a very strict 2-year path of just uncertainty. And it's really difficult to think outside the box or think creatively about how I can not live in the shadows, but then at the same time live as a normal person without status. It's just really difficult balancing those two. And I'll probably see when the time comes, but I'm not quite sure what my plan is.
You don't have a criminal record that I know of.
No.
Do you feel like, what do you feel like the odds are that you would be
deported? I don't think I might be deported because of, I think he's going to turn this into a meritocracy. And he's even used the word merit-based. Like those kids, like these beautiful kids that have done these things. So I know that I at least, thankfully, I've chosen politics and I've been stable in politics and I've done it for the past several years. I have built valuable relationships and have shared my story and have shown people that I'm more than a story, that I'm more than my status, that I am here because I belong here because this is my country. And if that were ever to happen, if I were ever to be in deportation proceedings, that I would just rally up this base of people that know me, that people that know more about me, and try my best to just stay in the country. But that should not be what undocumented immigrants have to resort to, because I've been very privileged to get access to these places.
What would be worse, being deported to Venezuela or living with the constant uncertainty of not knowing what's going to happen to you?
I feel like the risk of living in uncertainty is far lesser than living in Venezuela. Venezuela is just crumbling right now to pieces. And even all of my family members have left Venezuela to other places like Argentina, Panama, Madrid, Spain. All of the connections I have to that country is just reduced to my birth certificate. So I'd rather just be in uncertainty here and fight for what is right and what is good instead of going to a country where I can't have the freedom to do that.
What do you want people to know about you and the other so-called dreamers who were brought here undocumented as kids?
Well, I want them to know that it's a fight. These are the most resilient people that you will meet. They're fighting every day for existence. We wake up every day knowing that we are under threat of getting removed. We are not, like, the color of our skin, that our names, our first and last names, we are so visibly, like, threatening as how the president has presented us or presented undocumented immigrants as an overall image of criminals. We are exposed every day when we walk down the streets, but we still fight and we still walk down the streets and we still go to class. And the day after Trump was elected, I remember that students were still going to school. students were still like, I have lab at 4:50. Like, I have lab from 4:50 to 6:20. I can't stop and cry. Like, I need to do school. I need to do my homework. I need to go meet with my professors. We are resilient and we will act like everything is fine all the way, because we will not let the other side win. We will not let bigots and demagogues silence us like we've been silenced for so long. We've never experienced this. Not even under Bush was this threat of existence. We've never experienced this. So we're just going to go on with our lives and we're going to continue. And we're just going to continue fighting for what's right and what's good.
Graciela, do you ever think, I got to start calling myself Grace? I got to lose what accent I have left. You know, does that ever go through your mind, or friends of yours?
I did do that.
You did?
I did. Oh my God. In high school, I was called Grace. That was my nickname because I just wanted to make it easier for people. But then, like, the few times that I said Graciela, like, oh, my name's Graciela, people would always say, oh, that's a beautiful name. That's a beautiful name. And then obviously in college, I was just like, okay, this is such a beautiful name. Why am I going with something? I mean, I love all the graces of the world, but why am I going with something so basic when I have Graciela? Like, that's my name. And my parents didn't migrate here. We haven't put ourselves on the line just for me to change my identity. No, that's not my identity. My identity is Graciela. And it's also my grandmother's name, so I uphold her memory through who I am. So I will never change that. And the accent I have, I mean, who speaks two languages fluently and who can read and write them like I can and like many others can? People usually take 2 years of Spanish and they never remember it again. Like, I live with two identities, and I think that's a gift.
Graciela Nunez Pargas is a recent graduate of the University of Washington, and she's a DACA enrollee who lives in Tukwila. KUOW's immigration team is looking at the impact of the Trump administration on the lives of immigrants and refugees and the rest of us here in the Puget Sound region. To hear more stories and to share your thoughts, visit KUOW.org. The Tulalip Reservation, north of Everett, is right next to the fast-growing city of Marysville. And it used to be the town and the tribe didn't get along well. It's much better now. Reporter Joshua McNichols with KUOW's Region of Boom team tells you the story of how that changed.
The story begins in a small room in a small house on the Tulalip Reservation. That's where 88-year-old Wayne Williams is confined to his bed. He has a window where he can look out at a tangle of blackberry brambles. A caregiver waits on his every need. A little chihuahua alerts her if Wayne needs help. Sometimes Wayne howls, just to confuse the chihuahua.
I like to irritate him.
Wayne doesn't take crap from anybody, and neither did his grandfather, a man named William Shelton.
Oh, he was a very loving man, although you wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of him.
Wayne invited us to his bedside so he could tell us about his grandfather, William Shelton. It's hard for him to tell the story because of his health. But he wants to tell it, so people can understand how much has changed between Marysville and the tribes. He takes us back to a day in 1885 when his grandfather, William Shelton, ran away from his Tulalip home as a boy.
Well, he didn't run away, he paddled away.
He paddled away in a cedar canoe to join a boarding school run by Catholic priests. He had heard about reading and writing and believed it could help his people. Still, his decision upset his parents, who wanted little to do with a boarding school. I mean, just consider how bad things were next door in Marysville between whites and natives.
Originally, the people of Marysville didn't want the Indians to come to town.
The townspeople said,
they're all dirty and diseased.
Later in his life, Shelton became more deeply involved with the school when he got a job there. By that time, the government had taken the school over from the priests and turned it into a laboratory for assimilation. The school cut off Native kids from their families so they wouldn't be influenced by Native traditions. It tried them in a student court if they spoke Lachuteseed. Shelton embraced the strategy of assimilation. But at the same time, he didn't want to lose his culture. He began squirreling away Native artifacts. He filled his home with baskets, tools, and carvings. He stashed canoes in a wooden shed.
Well, he spent a lifetime gathering them. He felt that the way of life was passing away. He wanted to save it for the future, so they could see that we as a people had a valuable life too, and not just a bunch of dumbheads.
But Shelton didn't live to see that future. He died in 1938. The house and its treasures passed from generation to generation, finally coming to Wayne Williams. He protected the artifacts as his grandfather had.
Because I felt they were important, the history of our people.
Marysville historian Ken Cage says it's painful to remember the past and how white settlers treated the Tulalip.
What we did was bad.
But it didn't stay bad. The region began to grow. Tribal land became more valuable, and the tribe's fortunes began to improve. Mel Sheldon is the current Tulalip chairman. He describes how things improved when the Tulalip leased a big piece of land to Boeing.
When you had that type of cash income coming in, it did make an effect. It helped the tribe through the years.
Then, in the 80s and 90s, the Tulalip won the right to build and expand a casino on tribal land.
With the gaming, we've become an economic engine.
Today, the Tulalip tribe is the fifth largest employer in Snohomish County. It brought jobs and it made money. That did a lot to help erase some of the bad blood between the tribe and the town. And the money gave the tribe the means to heal that rift even further by building a tribal museum. They call it the Hebulb Cultural Center.
It was a dream for a long time, not only for our members, but for a greater public to come and see us and get to know who Tulalip Tribes is.
The museum hadn't opened yet when Wayne Williams invited them to haul off some of the artifacts his grandfather had collected. Tribal member Tessa Campbell had just been appointed as a curator at the museum. Next to Wayne's house, where a wooden shed had rotted away, she found a 40-foot cedar canoe covered in blackberry stickers.
It was just like a major discovery. I mean, I feel like it was like how an archaeologist would be when they find something in the ground. And it kept going. I mean, it was that feeling over and over again because we'd cut more sticker bushes and then, aha, another canoe.
Later, she would return for the baskets and carvings in his house. What Campbell found there became the highlight of her career and formed the largest part of the museum's Tulalip collection. Campbell thinks about William Shelton a lot. He tried to bridge two cultures, tribe and town, when those cultures seemed worlds apart. In a way, she's continuing his work.
Every time I'm on a microphone, I feel a connection to him because it's what he strived to do. He wanted to share our culture with the world.
Today, tribal members are welcome in Marysville. Historian Ken Cage is working on a separate museum of Marysville history, and he wants to give the Tulalip some space in that museum too, so Marysville can appreciate how much things have changed from the days when U.S. government agents burned ceremonial Tulalip artifacts.
Our agents couldn't understand why they could have such respect for a cedar tree. And, you know, it's one of the things that made it hard to bridge the gap, and that's what William Shelton did with all of his work, was to teach us, the white people, principles like that and how important they were.
Tulalip member Wayne Williams is glad he lived long enough to see the tribe's fortunes reverse.
Got better. They respect us now. We're not a bunch of dumbheads.
Over the years, the region around the casino has grown denser. Casino business continues to improve, and relations keep getting better. The tribe and the city of Marysville just completed a big project together, restoring part of the Snohomish River Delta. On the Tulalip Reservation, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
KUOW's Region of Boom reporting team has been embedded for a month in Marysville, city north of Everett that's growing faster than Seattle is. And next, the team heads to Black Diamond in southeast King County. Where else should they go? Let us know. Tweet at KUOW using the hashtag Region of Boom. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. A couple of weeks ago, a fire destroyed a Bellevue mosque. which is where the church next door comes in. Members of that Mormon church offered to share their building to give their neighbors a place to pray. I sat down this morning with Gordon Wilson, a member of the Mormon congregation there, and Tanvir Rahman, who is a board member of the Islamic Center of East Side. Tanvir told me how he found out about the fire at his mosque.
Early around 3 o'clock, got woken up by a phone call from another member of the board and said the mosque is on fire. So it quickly became very, very, dramatic for us. It was surreal.
How bad was the damage? What did it look like?
Oh, it looked like horrible. It looked like, as the daylight was breaking in, you could see, the extensiveness of the damage as well as the gravity of the damage. And it was a freezing night. So, as the water was coming out of, the fire hose and it falling down, it was freezing. So it was, it was slippery and it was really cold. And we tried to figure out what should we do? What should we do next? So city offered already a space for the congregation. So this is how the day started, going forward.
You needed a place to pray.
Yes.
Gordon, that's where you come in.
Well, eventually, yes.
Yeah. What was your first thought when you heard about the arson right next door?
It's shocking, of course. And nobody knows at first what the cause was. So the possibility of it being a hate crime is something that crosses your mind, especially when there has been some vandalism of the Bellevue Mosque and twice of the Redmond Mosque.
Right, that sign got damaged in Redmond.
Yes, it was. So that's one thought that always crosses your mind.
And the police, my understanding is that the arsonist, he didn't really talk much about Muslims, right? I mean, it's not considered a hate crime?
No, he. So far, what we know is that as an individual, he was known to the he came by before. So it's not somebody completely unknown to the community, but he he's probably someone who needs medical attention. So he, for whatever reason, decided to come in the morning and be there and do this.
Yeah, I found out that afternoon, Saturday afternoon, my son called me from Utah and told me, and I looked up the Seattle Times online, and then my wife and I drove over there and saw it. And it's very sobering to see a building that you're so familiar with a bunch of black timbers.
How did you come to offer your church as a place to pray for members of the mosque?
I'm sure you received offers from many other churches as well. The big question is, how can we help? And other churches also made the same offer of space, but we happen to be right next door. And now it took a few days to work out the details. Whenever you're sharing space and schedule in a physical facility, you have to figure out quite a few details and get some approvals. But by Wednesday of the following week, we had those approvals. And I got an email that night from the from our bishop, our current bishop, telling me that we would be sharing the space. And I immediately thought, hooray, same thing everyone else thought. We're all happy to help. And my wife and I drove over there, and she made a little welcome sign, and we taped it up to the windows, and because we knew they'd be starting the next morning.
What went through your mind?
It was very emotional because, as you can imagine, there are investigations going on from the, we're helping with the investigation, as well as it's a constant kind of, space struggle. This is more than help. I mean, this is like, because it's just next door. You don't even have to say anything. You can just put an arrow pointing, prayer next door. And so it was in a way surreal that it was coming together because, we were looking for a temporary solution. And the solution was just from my neighbor. And it's just,
a godsend.
It's a godsend, right, exactly.
Was there any religious or cultural hesitation about your mosque members, Muslims, praying in the Mormon church on either side? Is there an issue there?
To be honest, I think there were some hesitation because of the unknown factors. Not because of any known factor. So we didn't know, if we would offend someone by doing something. So the day one, when we met with the council and the president, we asked this question that, We'll just want to lay it down. I mean, this is extremely gracious of you to offer us the space. But, you know, we know our community. So unless you tell us, you know, we wouldn't know, you know. So, for example, you know, some of the stuff we're made aware. I myself learned, for example, the coffee and, you know, the tea and other things that are not, you know.
You're not going to bring coffee and tea into
exactly,
your services.
Exactly. You know, and something that you know, if you do not know, then you wouldn't, you know, consider. And what Sheikh Fazal does very well, our imam, is that after every prayer, they said, okay, you know, brothers, if you're going to have coffee, you know, leave it there. Don't bring the coffee into this property, you know. And no, of course, you know, mainstream, you know, Islam, we don't, smoking is not something that is encouraged. But, you know, still, if someone does it, I mean, we don't want to know about it. But most importantly, don't do it here. Mm-hmm. Don't do it in the parking. So a lot of this.
No rules, alcohol. You shared that in common.
That was an easy one. Yes. That was an easy one.
But notice in Tanvir's answer that the concerns that they had had to do with not giving offense. So it wasn't a theological issue. It was how do we be gracious neighbors?
Any neighbor feels a certain, well, that's them and this is us. And now you're compounding it with religion and, you know, language and accent and skin. I mean, was there any, you make it sound all like it came together very easily, but I'm wondering what that mix has been like.
That was one reason we felt like a welcome sign was important. Now, we had previously, the Sunday before that, put a couple of poster boards out on a table in our church, and members of the church had written notes to express their condolences to the mosque for the fire. And we laminated that and taped it up to the mosque itself. But when we learned they were going to be having their prayers in our building, we went and retrieved those posters from the mosque and taped them up on the glass, sliding glass door, and put them there, and also made this little welcome sign.
Do you remember what any of it said?
Well, there was one from a little boy that said, "I hope your mosque gets better." And he's about 7 years old. We just knew there has to be some trepidation from a congregation that has just been traumatized by an arson fire. So we wanted to, as part of our effort to be gracious hosts, we know how gracious they are. They are the nicest people in the world. We wanted to make sure we were trying to be nice also.
And here, Tanvir, your members were, they didn't know if they'd just been the victim of a hate crime. And this talk has been swirling around anyway. And
yes.
You had the vandalism in Redmond.
Yes.
You used the word traumatized.
Yes. You know, we're living in strange times. And, you know, of course, you know, when you see, because, you know, the mosque has received some, you know, vandalism in the past. And we try to deal with it, right? So we are trying to, we have a very good relationship with the police. We have a very good relationship with the city. And we try to kind of, you know, make people aware so that in case there was something that, you know, someone would do something like in Redmond, we would know, you know, what to do. But that didn't take away the element of worry from the larger congregation. I think the number one question in most people's mind is that, okay, you know, are we targeted? So all these things come to your mind and you want answers. You want answers more. You have more questions than answers. And then that creates a sentiment of, you know, fear, stress. And, you know, you want to have some level of comfort of knowing that, you know, there's a community. There's, you know, we can come together. And I think that has happened at a great, I mean, you know, the press conference happened the very day, you know, and the next day we had another one, town hall. So things happened very fast, but it happened so, it was so well organized that people felt the love and outpouring support, you know.
Let me mention that town hall meeting. The Sunday night, this was about 18 hours after the fire, the city had organized a meeting at the Sammamish High School auditorium, and I happened to be there. That room was packed. And it looked, to my observation, you can confirm or correct me, Tanvir, but it looked to me like about 2/3 to 3/4 of the people there did not appear to be Muslim. It was the community,
yes,
showing by their presence and their applause and the things they wrote on the poster boards outside of the room that they care and that the Muslims
That's
belong
correct.
In our community. They're part of us. And that was a strong message. And I think, this is not just about the Mormons and the Muslims. This is an entire community who
Right.
who really cares.
Your Muslim community was surprised?
Was completely overwhelmed, yes.
Overwhelmed?
Yes.
Was that not their experience of like where they fit in the community?
So think from this perspective, the expectations were that, you know, for many immigrants, you know, the experience from abroad is a little bit different. Most of the reports that we hear about, you know, whether mosque being vandalized or it's where the mosque is the victim of this, you know, situation. And you really feel that, okay, you know, the atmosphere is kind of, you know, feeding that. Here, the atmosphere is completely the opposite. It's in support. So that kind of, you know, feeling, that belonging, I think it's very, very, you know, it's very touching. It is emotional.
Mm-hmm. And now, how has the relationship changed between your congregations next door to one another? How are things different today?
I feel from our end that it has improved. The relationship in the past was mostly between the leaders of the two congregations, and now it's much more casual, informal, comfortable among everyday people. And that's a positive. Last Sunday, Adil Alarici from the mosque came and spoke at one of our church services and conducted a question-answer session, 15 or 20 minutes, and it was very helpful. And
do you remember what anybody asked?
Well, many of the men were asking, you know, how do I be polite and be respectful of the Muslim women? How do you avoid giving offense? What are the prayers like? Just questions like that.
Yes. And also we have received some of the members in during our congregation, because, you know, we said, okay, you're welcome to, you know, come and, you know, join us. We're just praying, you know, and if you want to come and observe us and have questions, you know, that we also opened that door.
Did your congregants have questions for the Mormons?
I think so. I think there were some.
Coffee or tea? Come on.
How do you do that?
I'm sure there are things everybody's learning. But I have had zero negative feedback. Nobody complaining. Many people expressing gratitude that we're able to help.
That is not the story we're hearing in this country.
Well, you know, I've been thinking about this too. This something like this shouldn't be newsworthy.
That's right.
It's common decency, honestly, and it's very obvious from in our faith. You know, Jesus said, "Love your neighbor." When he was asked, "What does that mean? Who's your neighbor?" He told the story of the Good Samaritan, meaning don't put limits on who you consider to be your neighbor. In this case, we don't even have to go on the road to Jericho to find our neighbor; they're right next door, and so. It was a no-brainer. And the fact that it's considered newsworthy, I think, is a contrast. It's because it's a contrast to the tension that exists in the national climate. But I think it's a lesson for all of us that the local takes precedence over the national, particular takes precedence over abstract.
Absolutely.
And when these are real people right next door, of course you're going to help. And the common decency is a lot more common than most people realize.
Do you think the arson and this cultural exchange has changed anyone's politics in either of your congregations?
I don't assume that anybody has changed their politics because of this, because I think most of our local members don't think this has anything to do with politics.
That's right.
This is just helping your neighbors. And it's not a political thing at all.
But you know that our feeling about our neighbors can translate into politics.
It's possible that some people will have had a shift in their views, but I certainly can't predict that.
Yeah.
It's just very particular to these people who are next door who need help.
So then finally, gentlemen, what is the lesson from your point of view? What's to be learned from what happened, the flames and then the response together, your mosque and church coming together?
It's reassuring to know, you know, that we are part of the Bellevue fabric. We're part of the, you know, Lake Hills. We're part of the, you know, it's very local, and it's really it reassuring to know that, you know, we have the same values, the same we share the street, but also the sentiments. I think that's how I would draw the line. That, you know, it gives you a sense of belonging.
Another lesson for me is that this Bellevue community really responded in a positive way to an attack on one subset of that community. And when you get face-to-face contact, all the theoretical, political discussions don't matter very much.
Tanvir Rahman, board member of the Islamic Center of East Side, Gordon Wilson, director of public affairs for the Bellevue Stake of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Thank you both for getting together and then telling us about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to KUOW's The Record. We are live tweeting this program at KUOW. In Washington, D.C., today, a top Republican's breaking with President Trump on the issue of voter fraud. The chair of the House Oversight Committee says he sees no evidence of voter fraud in the election, and his committee will not investigate it. Republican Jason Chaffetz of Utah says Trump is free to order the Justice Department to investigate, but the, quote, Oversight Committee is not planning to do anything with it. The president has claimed without evidence that at least 3 million people voted illegally in the election, denying him a popular vote majority. More news coming up through the day on KUOW Seattle. At KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. The fact that you're listening to me right now is remarkable. Think of all the competition there is for your attention. Social media, websites, TV, videos, advertising, other radio stations, if there are any other radio stations. Do you notice how relentlessly the world competes for your attention? What can you do about that? Our next guest is the author of the book, The Attention Merchants. Tim Wu, welcome to KUOW.
It's a pleasure to be here.
First of all, paint the picture. How much of our waking day is spent being pursued by the attention merchants?
I think anytime you're not asleep, frankly, I think, you know, things have gotten to the level. I don't know if you have this experience, but we are probably subject to at least 500, maybe 1,000 efforts to get a little bit of your attention every day. You think about all the email that comes in your inbox or like little things that flash when you're surfing the web or whatever else. It's just a kind of constant barrage. And, you know, it's new. It wasn't always like this in humankind. I mean, obviously like 1,000 years ago, we were just walking around the savannah, but even, maybe not 1,000, but a million. But it is definitely a byproduct of the last 200 years to have a world in where we're so totally immersed in a kind of an environment where people are always trying to get our attention because they think it's very valuable. And I think that's like one of the main facts of modern life.
Yeah, you write that the last scarce resource is going to be your attention.
I think that's right. You know, especially in rich countries, we have food and places to live and clothing. So the thing that has sort of become valuable is attention. I mean, politicians know that, particularly the current president understood that very well. You know, advertisers know it, but I think it's sort of becoming everything. If you don't get attention, you just don't get anywhere. You know, whether you're trying to launch a product or start a campaign or start a religion, it all is starting to come down to attention.
Well, what's so bad about somebody trying to get my attention? I can focus my attention where I want it, right?
If only that were true. Now, there's nothing necessarily wrong. I just think that it's very hard for us actually to control our attention. I don't know if you've had this experience where you go in your computer and you have this idea you're going to write one email to like a friend, and all of a sudden 2 hours have gone by and you just don't know what happens.
Yeah.
I think the honest fact is we're very bad at controlling our attention. And why that matters is that you need your attention if you want to do things. You know, let's say you want to learn to play the piano. Well, you actually have to cut off time and attention and spend time playing the piano. Or if you want to write a book or you want to spend time with your children, you actually have to control your attention. And so we live in an environment that is designed to be very hard. It's almost like we live in a casino, I feel like, sometimes.
Well, maybe we love craps. I mean, we're giving up some privacy and giving up some focus and getting all this low-cost functionality and connectedness and entertainment.
Look, I'm with you on that. I think people, you know, if you want to spend your time doing nothing but like channel surfing 16 hours a day, be my guest. But most of us have like a series of other goals and they kind of end up getting eroded or taken away from by the constant merchandising of our attention, the constant efforts to pull us into stuff. So that's what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned it's when we end up sort of not living the life that we really would choose to live and get sort of dragged into something quite different.
I don't know about you, but I'm getting better at not looking at ads, and I don't click on clickbait as much as I used to. Do you think we're learning to adapt and react to the attention merchants?
You know, I think we are somewhat. I will say that my book is a history. It's 150 years long, and the fact is people sort of learn immunities. We develop resources, but then typically advertisers and other groups that value attention will find something new to sort of try to seize you with. But I do think we're in something of, and frankly, right now, something of a revolt against advertising. I think it has reached kind of excessive levels where people like you, you know, just kind of install ad blockers or try and ignore it altogether. But I also, at the same time, wouldn't overestimate our ability to do that. You know, where I think human beings are constantly prone to overestimating themselves. And advertising does get through, or even if it doesn't, the content gets shaped by advertising content, and so you kind of end up being affected by it anyways.
You write about advertising that targets your particular vulnerabilities and character flaws. What does that mean?
Well, so we live in an age where obviously we are often trading our information for free stuff. You know, Facebook, most of us agreed to give over an enormous amount of information to Facebook for the right to see our friends and our friends' children, I guess. And, you know, when you know about someone, well, the more benign version of using that kind of information is, well, that guy likes motorcycles. I'll see if he wants to buy a motorcycle. But a darker version of it is like, that guy looks like he might have a gambling problem. Let's throw some casino ads at him. So, you know, that kind of stuff. And I mean, advertising has always sort of taken advantages of our weaknesses and vulnerabilities, but I think it's getting better at pinpointing them a little bit. Like, we're all a sucker for something. I wouldn't put myself above this. I, like anyone else, have weaknesses. And what's getting harder is that the advertisers know right to go for your jugular, effectively, like what you are particularly weak about.
We're talking with Tim Wu, who's the author of the book, The Attention Merchants. You mentioned the election. What does this presidential election tell us about our attention?
Yes, you know, I mean, everyone was shocked that Trump won, and I was one of them. But one thing I did notice, having written a book about the value of attention, is that Trump very deeply understood you have to win the battle for attention before you start to getting to the merits of an argument. Conversation is always about Trump. And I think, like, his metric is different. He doesn't care whether people think he won the argument. He cares if people are paying attention to him because he senses the more he has attention, the more he controls the agenda, the more basically it's about his power. So he has kind of understood this lesson in a way that's very hard for other people to digest. I think even hard for the media to digest because they assume, well, I'm covering this, you know, critically, so I'm diminishing him. But somehow it always just makes him more powerful. And I think that's a really important lesson going forward. It's like it is really all about attention. That's what makes celebrities generally so powerful in our time. I mean, you have a worthy cause, that's one thing. You have a worthy cause and, you know, some Madonna adopts a orphan or something. Suddenly it is, you know, something people talk about.
So can we expect this to be our future? Politics is for celebrities?
There might be a reaction in the American public against just the over-grandiose Trumpification of everything. But I do think it's really hard to run or win in politics without some kind of brand name at this point. I'm not saying people can't come out of nowhere, but I am saying that there's an enormous advantage in being a celebrity. And I wouldn't be surprised if it starts becoming relatively normal for pre-existing celebrities to just run for high office because, you know, why spend 20 years in politics to get there? Why not just go for it?
Well, now, Tim, that we're thinking about the attention industry, what can we do about it?
You know, I think it begins with awareness, like everything does, but really with people starting to retake their time and attention and understand how they spend it, because it does, it'll get dissipated pretty quickly. So, you know, you kind of have to set up some pretty hard rules for yourself, frankly. Boundaries, I think, where you're, or hardline rules. For example, maybe you don't use your computer, watch TV on the weekends or something like that. But I do think you have to sort of program your own life, especially if you want to get stuff done, even at work. I mean, if you want to be a productive employee, you might, even on your work computer, like shut down your internet or, you know, not surf the web all the time. And it's not easy. It's very hard to have that kind of self-control. I also think we need some government action to shut down some of the more abusive ways which our attention is stolen. So, for example, I'm extremely annoyed when you'll go to a movie theater where you're already paid, or even worse, when you're on an airline and you sit there and they start blowing ads at you and you're like, wait a second, what's going on? I can't even get out of here. You know, I think those kind of situations could use a little more of a hand just to make sure we at some point control our own spaces. I think that's very important.
Or at least if I realize how valuable my attention is to the rest of the world and I decide to give it away, how can I get something more in return for it?
Yeah, I think that's also right. Like, you know, policing the deal. Like, I have no problem. Sometimes things are worth it. I mean, some TV shows are really great, and if you get them for free and you watch an ad, and it's also if you're not rich, you know, watching ads is a lot cheaper than paying for stuff. But I just would be, you know, very demanding about the trade, I guess. The problem is we're kind of gotten used to kind of giving away for nothing because we don't even think of it as valuable. But it is extremely valuable. And you should always think, well, you know, I have other options. I could be doing something else. And if something just has too many ads, just say, forget it. I quit. You know, I'm done with it. So I think like policing the bargain is really important and something that we should be doing.
Sounds like you want us to stay rebellious, keep in touch with our inner hell no.
Absolutely. I mean, I think having read the history, I think these rebellions have a big effect. You know, in the 30s during the Depression, advertising was almost destroyed by people's rebellion against it. During the 60s, kind of countercultural period, that had an effect. Ultimately, advertising, if you ever watched the show Mad Men, ended up co-opting the counterculture. That's a sort of different story. But I just think it is really important, yeah, that we remain independent citizens. This has to do with, like, what kind of people we are. And attention merchants would basically like us to be kind of sitting there watching hours and hours of so-called content and absorbing as many advertisements as we can and then sort of doing what we're told. But I'm sort of strong feelings about people taking control over their own lives. And in our times, that means taking control of your attention. That's where it starts.
Tim Wu, author of The Attention Merchants. We really appreciate the time. Thank you.
Sure. And I appreciate the attention.
Yeah, you're welcome. I could have been doing anything else right now.
It's true.
This is KUOW Seattle. Speaking of holding our attention, the ABC show Grey's Anatomy. Why is it still going after 13 seasons? Is it just that it's set in Seattle and we're riveting here in Seattle, or is there more? We'll figure it out later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered.